This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everybody. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Radio every Tuesday and Wednesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time or by going to our site at www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen to our past shows on our iPod Ready Archive section. That's www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. And now, friends, you can also listen live via satellite on your Nokia phone. Just go to the website for details. As you can tell, I'm really excited tonight. I just think that this is like earth-shattering. That's the only thing that I can think of. One of our guests tonight, and the other one is a director and producer extraordinaire, filmmaker, archaeologist, explorer, adventurer. Director Bruce Burgess has just completed a film produced by Rene Barnett that can only be considered, as far as I'm concerned, again, earth-shattering. Dan Brown's novel, The Da Vinci Code, inspired a new line of thought that has, for some, taken a turn to a reality that may break the rules of religion and history. The producer of this documentary, Rene Barnett, along with Bruce Burgess, in the three-year making of this film, have been privy to the uncovering of new evidence that may suggest the life of Jesus Christ was not the story told and revered for generations by Christians and theologians. During the course of this show, we will try to find out just how this may or may not impact the world of Catholicism and religion. Bruce, Renee, welcome to The People Speak.
Thanks very much. We're glad to be here.
Well, it is a thrill and an honor. First of all, I have to congratulate the both of you. What an incredible film. It has everything, the intrigue, the depth of investigative journalism. It is just really a fantastic film. And for those of you, when is the film going to be released?
We're premiering in New York City on May 9th. And then the following week, opening in Los Angeles on May 16th, and hopefully after that, a nationwide rollout.
Congratulations. Do you know if it's going to be in mainstream theaters at all, Renee?
Well, we certainly hope so. That's what we're counting on.
Well, so I'm counting on it, too, because this really is amazing stuff. Bruce, can you briefly share a synopsis with our listeners that may not be familiar with the issues that you're documenting in the film Bloodline?
Well, 4 years ago now, we set out to investigate the truth behind Dan Brown's novel, essentially, and the so-called Bloodline Conspiracy. And the Bloodline Conspiracy basically is that Jesus Christ married Mary Magdalene, that they had children, and that Mary Magdalene, either pregnant or with their children, and either with Jesus alive, who perhaps escaped the crucifixion, or with his body, if indeed he was crucified, went to France, where they remain buried today. And that was pretty much the thesis of Dan Brown's book, which itself was based on earlier French history and on a book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which came out in 1982. And we were fascinated by that. Renee had been, you know, kind of investigating this subject as a hobby for, you know, since that book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, came out in 1982. And when we heard about the Da Vinci Code film, we thought, wow, you know, we're documentary makers. We know some of this material. Let's do a documentary on it. Not knowing, you know, whether it was true, whether it wasn't, whether we could find anything. The question was, you know, where to start? Where do you start investigating what some people have called the greatest cover-up of all time? And the answer was this mysterious secret society called the Priory of Sion, which again features at the very front of Dan Brown's book under the headline Fact. And he has drawn on lots of sources for his description of the Priory, but essentially the Priory and those who, you know, looked into it claim that it's a secret society that goes, can trace itself back to the very beginning, even pre-Crusades in Jerusalem, that it was founded in around 1080, 1100 in the 12th century. And that from the Priory of Zion, the Knights Templar emerged, and that both the Priory and the Knights Templar, down now through nearly 1,000 years, have protected the idea of this bloodline, the secret of the bloodline, descendants of the bloodline. And they've done this because they believe and they protect and, you know, they're sworn to this because they believe that the church has deliberately covered up the truth about who Jesus Christ was, who the historical Jesus Christ was, his relationship to Mary Magdalene, and that there exists a truth which is completely different to the doctrine of the Christian Church, that he wasn't the Son of God, he was a regular man who had a wife, and that for political reasons and political expediency and to create their own power base, the church deliberately covered up the truth. And really, therefore, the Priory have been the guardians of this secret, the guardians of this truth, the guardians of this bloodline. And we both sat down and said, well, if we could find the Priory, and they still exist today, then they would have the evidence, they would have the access, they would have the documents that you really need to move this whole debate onto the next level, and that's where we started back in 2004.
You know, Bruce, to say that at the very least this is earth-shattering, but it is, in fact, earth-altering. How, and as I've witnessed across the board in many areas, not just in this particular area, obviously you both have dealt with this type of conspiratorial type mindset that people, you know, somehow, as soon as they hear it, step back and say, oh, that's just a bunch of hooey, let's not go there, let's deal with facts. But one thing that I've witnessed is that in many areas that most people are perfectly happy believing the myth, even when presented with the truth. To me, this documentary held a lot of, if not answers, but certainly opened up a lot more areas of questioning. How do you feel about how people will perceive this documentary? You and Renee.
Yeah, I've got a little thing that I'd always like to get across, and then let Renee give her take on it. I've always been amazed. You know, I grew up the Church of England faith in England, but I never really locked on to it. At school, I was kind of forced to go to church, as you are, and I never really had a strong religious code or belief. But I think, in a way, perhaps I represent the majority of people. You know, religious extremism on any front, whether it's Christian or Muslim or Jewish, you know, it tends to be the minorities that make the most amount of noise, and that the majority, we're pretty apathetic and quiet, and we just listen to them all rant on. So I think there are millions, there are tens of millions, there may be hundreds of millions of people just like me who don't really have a defined religion, but we're interested. Of course we're interested. Who the hell is God? You know, who was Jesus? Where am I going when I die? I think we all care, but we just don't have these, you know, fundamental extremisms of, you know, that polarize. And what's really fascinated me is when you talk to a priest, as I've done many times and have many theological discussions, they will look you in the eyes and tell you that Jesus is the Son of God, that he ascended into heaven, that he created these miracles, that he turned water into wine, that he loaves and fishes, and they will, without blinking, they will look in your face and tell you that's absolutely true. And when I say, when I start asking them, but, you know, he was a regular man who, you know, woke up feeling hungry and married a woman and fell in love and did all these, you know, absolutely normal things, they look at you like you're from the planet Mars. And to me, that's just ludicrous that the church will hang on to stuff that's completely unproven and outlandish, and yet the very basic human instincts of love and lust and desire and, you know, does my bum look big in this, it's completely alien to them, and that view completely alienates me.
Well, Renee, how does one take
on it than Bruce does? And this is, I think, why we're a good team, because we're oftentimes coming from opposite ends. I conversely grew up in the southern part of the United States, in southeastern Oklahoma, and came from a Southern Baptist upbringing. So I had quite a different experience. And although, you know, I do recall, you know, being a young girl in church and thinking, gosh, you know, there seems to be something I'm just not getting, or something that just doesn't seem quite complete here to me. And I thought, well, it must be me. I must be just a bad person, because I'm not feeling the Holy Spirit like everybody else seems to be in the congregation and that sort of thing. And I did a lot of studying and reading on my own. And then, you know, as Bruce said, in 1982, I picked up the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And that was the first time that I'd heard the idea set out that Jesus might have been married to Mary Magdalene. And there was something about that that sort of struck me as, gee, that's possible. That's really plausible. That sounds a lot more reasonable to me. And it introduced me to other things like the Nag Hammadi Library, and, you know, which contained things like the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, which showed that, you know, women were not only, you know, equal, but sometimes very important in those days. And that's been hidden from us. And I think that Margaret Starbird is in our film, and one of the things that she said about it that gives me hope and makes me feel good about what we've done is that maybe this is the renewal of Christianity. Maybe this is the second coming. And now we have Jesus with his partner alongside him as our model.
Let me ask you both, how can this be taken seriously, and how does one actually disseminate a myth that mankind has literally lived and died for centuries?
Well, the can it be taken seriously, I think, is a really good question, Massimo. And when we set out to do this, we didn't want to do what, let me rephrase it. Both Renee and I, and many of your listeners, you included, I'm sure, have seen dozens upon dozens of documentaries on the History Channel and the Discovery Channel, analyzing every ounce of Dan Brown and asking the question, was Jesus married? I felt that to a T, every single documentary basically was a copy of another, and all it was really a succession of authors promoting their own books and talking, having a kind of theological debate about interpretation of the Bible. Why? Because no one has a single shred of evidence to do anything more than that. It's all conjecture. And the one thing we set out to do was, why do another one? You know, we're way off the curve. That all happened kind of 4 years ago. What can we bring to the table that's new? And so we set ourselves a very high standard. If we can't find any credible evidence that moves this debate along, then, you know, essentially we probably just will stop doing the film. And so we are different. And why should people take us seriously? Because I guess I describe it as, you know, we haven't got proof, absolute proof, that Jesus married Mary. What we have, and to put it in context, you know, this is probably the greatest of all mysteries. What I think we have is a foot in the door, a crack in the window, a slit in the curtain, which is huge. You know, just to get that is huge. You know, and why do we have that? Because we have confessions of a Catholic priest from the 19th century in France who completely refutes his doctrine. And anyone who knows anything about history knows that that's unprecedented. 100 years ago in a Catholic country, in a little country priest, to write his confessions and say the heretics, you know, are the church in Rome, they know that the doctrine's wrong, is huge. That was only the beginning. Then we found actual relics buried, that he buried in the ground, which had been handed down to him, which, again, you know, we've had tested and analyzed as authentic first century relics in Jerusalem, which he says were relics used at the marriage of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And that's when it really started getting interesting for us. And of course, as you know, because you've seen our material, we also found a tomb with a body in, which we've had just very early stages of analysis with DNA, which shows a Middle Eastern heritage. And so whether we're compared to the Discovery Channel docs, which basically are talking heads, or even, dare I bring it up, James Cameron's documentary, which were two, you know, empty ossuaries, no one's really had anything to talk about. And so, you know, we're completely overwhelmed that we found what we found. But to recap, as to why people should take it seriously, we're not a theological debate. We don't bend your ears about my interpretation of Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. This is fact. This is factual confessions of an actual priest, actual first century relics, which I can reach across and hold in my hand, and an actual tomb with a body in. And so we've still got an awful long way to go, Bassema, but what we really think we've established is like a kind of bridgehead into the doctrine, because you can't just dismiss this as conjecture or theory. This is fact, and this is why, you know, we're so excited, and at the same time, you know, we know we're going to have a huge fight on our hands with, you know, people who don't want the doctrine challenged.
Yeah, Bruce, one of the things that, and for our listeners that are not aware, during the course of this investigative documentary, Bruce and Renee, along with a gentleman by the name of Ben Hammett, actually discovered an archaeological treasure. This was, can you explain exactly what was, and I have to tell you though, I must say that as Ben Hammett was digging in that site, that he discovered, I couldn't help but cringe. And I could not help but recall the Dead Sea Scrolls and other artifacts that have floated around among the mass population for years without understanding their significance, that many would actually use this lack of expertise in the archaeological field to disregard incredible findings due to a lack of what they would call good science. But in the end of the film, I felt that it was so important, Bruce, that you had said, most discoveries in the world have come just this way. And can you tell us about the discovery and what led up? It was just amazing, just totally amazing.
Now, if you're talking about the digging, you must be talking about the cave in which the chest was found with the relics.
Yes. Exactly.
It was a cave. It's called the Cave of the Magdalene. It's outside the village of Rennes-le-Château. And following some clues that were embedded in the decor of the church there at Rennes-le-Château, the Church of Mary Magdalene, by the way, Ben did some calculations, and which we followed to this location, which ended up being in the Cave of the Magdalene. And eventually we dug there and pulled out this chest. It was an 18th century wooden box. And inside were articles which had been sort of advertised to us in these clues that we were following from the priest. There were an unguentarium, or an anointing jar, a small copper bowl, and a glass vial, or alabaster vial, containing a small parchment, along with a collection of coins. The coins ranged in age from 100 years B.C. to up through the 12th century, up through the Crusades. And the other items all dated back to 1st century Jerusalem. That was the one find. And then there was another find, which is the Bruce was just talking about, the tomb, in which Ben Hammett was the original discoverer. And inside that tomb, which can only be accessed through a small air shaft. We actually threaded cameras down through that in order to get the footage that we did, and also some other equipment to obtain some hairs from the body so that we could get the DNA samples. But the tomb itself contains what appears to be a mummified body covered in a shroud bearing a distinctive red cross. It appears to be the symbol of the Knights Templar. And surrounding that body are items, chests full of treasure, chalices, gold coins, other items, and some old parchments which are lying around, that you can see. And also a huge, huge old book, which is very interesting to me. I'd love to be able to get hold of that and see what's there. And we will do that once there's a full examination of that site.
Now, when you say a full examination, currently the French government is in process of preparing for a dig. Are they not on that very site, Renee and Bruce?
Well, we've duly reported the find to the French government, and yes, we're waiting for the right time to go back and to do a full examination. I'll let Bruce talk more about that.
Yeah, I mean, no one's ever found, we don't know what it is, because just to recap for your listeners, because that was a lot of information, the only access we have to this tomb is a small air shaft which goes down, zigzags its way down through the rock about 6 meters before it hits the burial chamber, and it goes down, you know, from inside the cave down to the burial chamber. You can't see the tomb at all. It's because of the way the rock zigzags. So everything all the filming we've done so far in it, and being able to collect a small hair sample, it's been incredibly tricky in order just to do that. So there's no chance at the moment to pull anything out for examination. What we're at, the next stage is to determine how we get in. And the reason this is taking so long is the structure and the strength of the roof of the tomb. We can't just kind of hack away at it, and even with our best amateur archaeology hats on, that, you know, we'd recognize that the wrong move and you could collapse the entire thing on top of the corpse. So it's a difficult one. People who are listening to this are now imagining their own picture, but it's not like Tutankhamun's tomb with a big doorway and you bash through and you're in. We're looking down on this, and if you start drilling through basically the cave floor, the whole lot could collapse and this could be lost forever. So that's why it's taking so long. And the next step is to determine the kind of, I'm searching for the word, but it's the strength of the roof. It's the integrity, that's it, of the roof. Once we've done that, we'll find a way in. Once we can get in, then of course this gets very interesting. As far as the French government are concerned, if they want to take it slow, this could be, you know, one of the greatest finds that's ever been made. No one's ever found a Templar tomb intact. And just looking at the footage, as Renee said, you can actually see books, parchments, and some wooden chests which are open, half open, and you can clearly see chalices and jewels and coins. That begs the question: what is this? And we talked to loads of
Bruce,
experts.
The actual cave of the Magdalene. This is a definitive property. Who is the owner of the property that this cave is on, or is there an owner? Is this just an area?
Now, before he answers that, this is not the same location. We're not talking about.
Anyway, go ahead, Renee.
No, we're just going to say the tomb is in a different location than the Cave of the Magdalene.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I guess I was just so engrossed in watching what you were finding down there that I lost sight of that one. It's amazing. It really is. Now, one of the things that I also want to touch upon, and I think it's very important to bring this whole picture together, Renee and Bruce, is that a lot of what was going on, I got the impression, by some of the interviews that you were conducting, that people knew that you were doing this. They knew that you were searching for these things. And when you found it, they were not surprised. Who are they, and what is their significance to your findings?
Well, I guess you might be referring to the two gentlemen we interviewed from the Priory of Sion.
Yes.
Basically, the Priory of Sion, you know, goes back to the 12th century, but essentially for 1,000 years, no one's heard a peep out of them until about 1950, and a man in Paris called Pierre Plantard de Saint-Clair basically started briefing journalists and the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail, that not only did the Priory of Zion still exist, had existed under the radar for 1,000 years, but that he was its Grand Master, and that great things were going to be coming out leading up to and immediately after the millennium. And in many ways, he was as good as his word, because from 1950, pretty much up to today, documents, meetings, briefings, some people said complicity with Dan Brown in the Da Vinci Code. The Priory of Zion, for an organization that's remained completely in the shadows for a millennium, has spent an awful lot of time and effort and perhaps money promoting themselves and their mission, which is, as they state, to tell the world the truth that the church has deliberately, you know, misled people about the truth about Jesus and Mary Magdalene, and silenced, killed, and, you know, covered up anyone and anything that challenged it. We met two men who claim to represent it today, someone from their inner circle and someone who's their general secretary. They both confirmed that there was a tomb or tombs of great importance near this village of Rennes Chateau, and that the priest whose clues we followed, who's called Beranger Saunier, who was the priest in the village of Rennes Chateau at the end of the 19th century, did indeed find something that was, you know, earth-shatteringly important enough to make this poor man basically break with his faith and die, a broken individual. And so, yes, they know what's down there. At no point, though, did they say, here's the treasure map, go and find it, X marks the spot. Our entire dealings with them has been almost on a kind of esoteric Masonic level, where they will help you to a point, but they help you to help yourself. So, you know, they've given us the wherewithal to kind of progress and find things. They want it out, but their whole modus operandi is, I guess it's, you almost have to be worthy of the discovery. They're not just going to hand it to someone. They've obviously, you know, they could have done that any time in any of the centuries to get this out. They say they were waiting for the right people to come along, and they say that's us.
How do you feel about that, both of you? How do you feel about that? That is, like, huge. I mean, these are people that are all... Go ahead,
Renee. I don't know. I mean, you know, we've been saying all along, you know, why us? Why did we get to find these things? Why did we get to meet the Priory of Zion? We don't know why. I mean, I think it was the right time, the right place. We made the right connections, and we came through with the right attitude, I believe, and intention was a big word that they used when we met them for the first time.
I mean, we've both been making films on television for the last, decade or so, and there is a slightly common thread here, which is, you know, we tackle subjects as diverse as UFOs to the Bermuda Triangle, Bigfoot, the Ark of the Covenant, the Holy Grail, and I like to think that each of the films gives people who are essentially on the margins of society, because people get laughed at if you say you're going to look for the Ark of the Covenant, or you get laughed at if you say you've seen a UFO, or you get laughed at if you think you've seen Bigfoot, or you believe the Boom in the Triangle. And we always approached our films not as skeptics or as pessimists or know-alls, but rather that, you know, there are millions, tens of millions of people who have either experienced or believe very strongly in these things, and we've tried to give them a voice. And maybe that's why we're the right people to do this, because it doesn't matter to me that Ben lives in a camper van and has no money, really. And that doesn't make his discovery any less important than King Tut's tomb. And as you said, it annoys the hell out of me that pompous academics and museums kind of who have and will continue to look down on what we're doing, when they didn't do anything, all they did was trade in a very ugly, commercial, unseemly fashion, grabbing between the British Museum, Smithsonian. They didn't find anything. They either bought, stole, or took credit for other people's work. And it's the little people on the ground in the dirt, like, you know, Ben. And so, you know, I think it, in a way this film is a continuation of us sticking up for the little people. And, you know, this could be the biggest, it probably is and will be the biggest thing we'll ever do.
Renee, Bruce, people died during the making of this film. A father and a son were shot. Another member of, I believe, the Priory of Sion died a mysterious death that you spoke of in the film. Can you talk to us and elaborate a little bit on both of those?
Well, it was interesting. During the course of about a year, it seemed that there were three members, purported members of the Priory of Sion who died. And they all died in the same way, by cerebral hemorrhage or stroke. And Basma, I know you saw the film, so you know that Bruce asked Nicholas Haywood in the Priory of Sion just about that mode of death, and he let us know that it was indicative of a certain poison that's used in that sort of, you know, secret society intelligence type community. We can't say for sure that that's what happened. We did know that we were on our way. We were about a week out from an interview with a gentleman, Lord Patrick Litchfield, and he suddenly fell ill at a party and collapsed and didn't regain consciousness. I believe died later that same day, cerebral hemorrhage or stroke once again. And we'd been told that we were to meet with him in about a week's time and that he would open his secret archives to us. And interestingly, you know, and tragically, we never got to have that interview.
It was controversial because it's going to not mean much to your listeners until they see the film, but there's a painting by Nicolas Poussin called The Shepherds of Arcadia, which Nicolas Poussin is a 17th century French artist, and it depicts a group of shepherds and a shepherdess looking at a tomb. Well, that tomb was a real tomb. It actually existed near the village of Rennes-le-Château. And we were told by the Priory that's absolutely at the core of its secret. And it's probably literally means that they represent and protect an actual tomb underground in the area. Lord Litchfield had that painting in his study. And
he had a monument to it
had a monument in the grounds of his house. Add to that the fact that he was actually, you know, he was the Queen of England's cousin. So, yes, we're not saying, there's absolutely no proof that somehow Lord Litchfield was killed before he was going to talk to me. He died just days before he was going to talk to me. And I think when you add to that the phone taps that I had, the wiretaps, the hacking of our site, which continues to this day, I think there are definitely people out there who want to stop us promoting our film, who would like to stop our film coming out. I think there are kind of harmless enthusiasts, and I think if you look at the modus operandi of people connected with the extreme elements of the Catholic Church, then there are people who have, you know, there's many, many millions of people have died at the hands of the Inquisition, at the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, which, of course, Pope Benedict ran for 20 years. And so, you know, are there people out there trying to stop us? Yes. Do we know who they are? No. Do I have a strong idea of who they are? I think I probably just told you.
Just again, absolutely brilliant. Professor Robert Eisman, and I'm reading here from your information, a leading figure in the translation and publication of the Dead Sea Scrolls, emphasized the need to carbon date the corpse that was found. I have no doubt that the items will be found authentic, but how did they get there? Where does science come into these theories, Bruce?
Well, it's already come into play because we've had a DNA test done on the hair from the corpse, which, because the hair is likely to be so ancient, that we've only been able to get a mitochondrial read, which all it gives us is the origin of the ancestors of that corpse, which we know is a very rare haplotype that originated in the Middle East. We don't yet know the sex or age. And obviously, we want to fully carbon date the corpse so we can get the age. We want to test all everything in there. So the next step is to bring in, you know, is to bring in the scientists, because that's really going to, what's, you know, the first step now is to announce what we found, which is fantastic. The next step is to bring in the scientists and analyze what it is we have so that it can be beyond reproach, because, you know, and we know, and everyone listening knows that, you know, there's going to be a huge backlash from whoever wants to maintain the doctrine, and which is obviously based on faith, and want to do everything they can to stop anything based on fact and history coming out. So I should add that, in addition to the DNA test that we did, which obviously is science, we also had a carbon dating done on the small rolled parchment that was found inside the glass vial, which was in the wooden chest. And we went to Oxford University Radiocarbon Lab, which is the most famous and most prestigious in the world, who had dated the Turin Shroud. And they came back with a date of 99%, 98% probability that it dated from 1452, in other words, the 15th century. And so all the way along, Bessemer, I say this because, you know, people are going to be listening to this who are going, well, isn't it, you know, aren't they just making all this stuff up in Bruce's kind of garage? Isn't he making all these old tea-stained documents and it all looks very nice, but is it real? No. I mean, you know, we've been to the leading authorities with the pottery at the British Museum and in Jerusalem. They're authentic first-century relics. We've carbon-dated the parchment that was in the vial. It's from the 15th century. But this is not stuff you can do in your backyard. This is real. And so, yes, we've done some science, and science, I think, is the key to so many people's belief in this, because it's not enough just to say this is fascinating and interesting and has, you know, I think in order to really move the debate on, people want to see the analysis. But so far, all the science that we've done and all the analysis we've done has told us that it's real, you know, that, and that it's old.
Well, obviously there are many people, Bruce and Renee, that have a vested interest in this information coming to light. Do you believe, when you looked at the, and obviously for our listeners, it's difficult to understand the way the corpse was discovered. There was a small doorway that seemed to have been sealed up by other stones. And during the course of the discussion with, I believe it's Wayworth is the name, Lord Wayworth?
Hayworth,
I'm sorry. He suggested that this was, he didn't suggest that this particular room, but that there was an area that had many such corpses and many such areas, and it was much greater than you would imagine. And he also alluded to the fact that perhaps that you were being presented with information in order to make these discoveries. How do you feel about that? Do you think that part of this may have been staged in order to get this information out at a strategic time or an agenda-based time?
To go back to the beginning there of your question regarding that blocked up doorway, you know, we don't know what's beyond that blocked up doorway, but we certainly have reason to think that there might be a bigger repository on the other side of that. This could be what is called a satellite tomb that is on these sort of outer edges of that bigger repository, bigger necropolis. So we don't quite know just yet. Once we get into the tomb, we'll go through that doorway and see. I mean, our film is done, but our investigation is certainly not anywhere near finished, and we'll carry on.
You know, there was a very strong local belief that there was a large necropolis very near the tomb site, in which that's been used for centuries. There was a Jewish community there from 500 BC, all the way through to the Knights Templar settling four major fortresses around this valley in the 12th and 13th century. And we have no idea, you know, what we're going to find in there until we find it, and it would be wrong to speculate too much. But, I imagine there's going to be a necropolis that dates all the way from that early Jewish settlement through to the Templars. What, of course, we're very excited about is, you know, what the Templars brought back from Jerusalem has never been found. And the so-called lost treasure of the Templars is one of the kind of holy grails of archaeology, which could include the Grail itself.
The Ark of the Covenant.
The Ark of the Covenant, you name it. And so, we in a way, we've tried to play that down in the film, because it's very easy, as soon as you start talking about the Grail or the Ark of the Covenant, everyone's kind of, their hearing shuts off, and that's all they hear. And so, yeah, we don't know. Are we going to find the tombs of Jesus, Mary Magdalene, and their family? Are we being led to an incredible stash of, you know,
treasure
of the Templars? We don't know. What we do know is it's not theory anymore. That, yes, there is a tomb with a body in it, and there's a blocked-up entrance, which means someone has been in and gone out. My money goes back to that little old priest in Rennes-le-Château in the 19th century, Béranger Saunière. I think this is one of the tombs, if not one, you know, that he found, and that he blocked it up, and that no one's been in there since. And that would explain why it's in reasonably good condition, and why some of the boxes are open, because part of his mystery was, after he discovered this poor priest who only earned about 700 French francs a year, when you look at his accounts, he spent something like
$3 million.
About $3 million. So the conspiracy theorists have been debating this for years. Did he find treasure? How did he get them with this extra money? It's either from finding a treasure and selling it, or he found something which he then blackmailed perhaps the Vatican, you know, to keep him quiet. But somehow this little priest in his backwater village got incredibly rich. And, you know, that every which way we turn, we're not finding reasons to question what we found. We're finding facts that corroborate that this really is something very special.
Which is the astounding thing about this. For those of our listeners that would like to speak to our guests, Renee Barnett and Bruce Burgess, on the impending release of their earth-shattering, groundbreaking film, Bloodline, you can call us at 877-489-6350, or toll-free in the U.S. and Canada at 888-228-4494. That's 877-489-6350, or U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494. I'd like to ask, obviously, you know, one of the things that I found that was of interest is you have focused on the Priory of Sion. You focused on the issues of the Vatican, the issues of this sweet old priest that, like you said, died beleaguered and probably quite terrified at from everything that I can see, Father Saunière. The film leads to the understanding that the Illuminati may be involved, as well as the Prior of Sion and the Vatican. Why is it that humanity is finding it such a difficult concept to accept as a truth, that indeed there may very well be things that have been hidden? The mystery of the Christian Church, I think, is I don't think it was ever intended to be a mystery. I think it was intended to be mystical, but certainly not a mystery. And I think this mysterious aspect of it has led all of us to question these things. Why is it hard for man to give up this myth? Why do we have such a hard time with these concepts? Why do we want to believe it's all tricks and mirrors and Hollywood movie?
It's a good question. Renee's probably got a very good answer to that. But what I wanted to say at that point, we dude, when we get towards the end of the film, I don't want to give away too much. Suffice it to say that we do, as you know, talk to someone, an insider at the Vatican at the end of the film. And
yes.
When they see the film, they'll see what that person says, and it is, I think you'd agree, quite shocking. What that person also went on to say, you know, obviously we can only use a bit of it in the film. This is someone who's been at the top of the Vatican, worked at the top of the Vatican for decades. He turns around as part of that interview and says, you know, he's never seen as the Vatican as anything except a political entity. And I hope that goes a long way to answering your question, because it answers, you know, why are we in the situation we're in? Why have so many lives been perpetrated? Why is it so difficult for the church and its followers to accept something different? Because, as it was explained to me, the Vatican have always known the truth, and that they didn't cover it up because they thought it was a jolly jape to do. They did it because it was about power and money and control. And I think once you look at 2,000 years, essentially, of Christianity, from everyone, from Constantine's, you know, super quick conversion, kind of on his deathbed, all the way through to the Vatican today, it's about power and control and money. It's about people, you know, to some extent preying on the weakest elements of society, like a corporation. I think people forget that, you know, the Vatican have forgotten more about intelligence and secrecy and spying than the CIA have ever known. You know, the whole basis of international intrigue, of assassinations, of, you know, it's the Vatican. And, you know, the Inquisition is the model by which, you know, so much, you know, all this kind of intrigue and assassinations and death was based. So I had no problem. I don't see the Vatican as, I can hear Opus Dei knocking on the door as I say this, but I don't see the Vatican as the seat of Peter and this holier-than-thou institution. I see them as, I don't want to use the word the evil empire, but I certainly see them as ruthless, let's use that word, as GE or any massive corporation. And are they doing it? To some extent, they're just doing it to keep the money rolling and the chauffeurs and the free trips and the corporate jets and the $50,000 ermine robes and everything else that they've got. I don't really see a very humble connection to, you know, maybe an incredibly spiritual prophet who lived 2,000 years ago. I see something that's completely out of control, who will go to any length to keep the money rolling.
Well, I certainly agree with you. I can't imagine ever assuming that the Vatican would be have any anything to do with what people considered humility. We have a question from Brian from England, an email question. And his question is, does the term bloodline suggest that there are relatives of Jesus alive today?
Well, I think the answer to that is yes. However, I'm not sure that it carries a huge significance to us or to this film. What is more important about the idea of the bloodline was that it existed at all. Because if it does, then that means that Jesus was married, Jesus did have children, and the story that we've been given is wrong. However, you know, we did talk about this idea of a bloodline and there being certain representatives of it today. That's just not our focus.
Well, we in the Da Vinci Code film, obviously famously, Audrey Tautou is, you know, dropped the bombshell up at Rosslyn Chapel that she is the living heir and keeping on the bloodline. That's all, from what we understand, scientific nonsense. You know, our investigations into genetic descent is that anyone who lived 2,000 years ago, whoever it was, Jesus or Jesus's tailor, that everyone today will have some of that DNA in them. That's just how it works. So when we put that question to a geneticist, we said, is it possible that the Priory and other people are descended from Jesus Christ? He went, absolutely yes, but so is everyone else. And so I guess the good news, Bassimer, is that we've all got the DNA of Jesus and Mary Magdalene in us. Whether we can walk on water, though, is is something completely different.
Well, I walk on water all the time. Or so my family tells me. Rob from Canada, another email question. Why the cross if he wasn't crucified?
Oh, the cross is a much more ancient symbol than...
Does he mean the cross in the tomb?
I believe he means the cross on the, of the crucifix.
Yes, I guess he's probably... I'm not quite sure the question. Is he saying why the cross in Christianity, or...
Okay, I just got a rephrasing of the question. Why the red cross of the Templars if Jesus wasn't crucified? I see. Okay, I think they're talking about the fact that the corpse was placed in a shroud and there was a Templar's cross on it.
Well, Renee,
because obviously that becomes a very significant part of that.
Yeah, the cross. I mean, the Egyptians had the beginning of a cross. It was the Ankh, and the cross is a symbol long predated Christ, and that. I think one of the things that we've come back to time and time again in this mystery is that the priory and the people connected to the priory are not just interested in the story of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. They're interested in a kind of ancient underground stream of spirituality, or as they call it, gnosis, which existed prior to Christianity and then was basically forced to go underground ever since then. And the cross is kind of representative of that underground spirituality as much as more than it is the crucifixion.
I'd like to ask Renee and Bruce, each of you, if you would, indulge me in this. What do you think the ultimate significance and impact on the world, and specifically the monotheistic religions, if the information and the artifacts, in light of them ever being proven to be real, do you believe that this is going to change the face of Christianity?
Well, I would hope so. I don't know if our film is going to change anything. If more information does come out, I mean, as I was saying earlier, I mean, maybe this could be the new model for Christianity, and maybe this is what it should have been all along. Maybe this is why we have a world out of balance and out of kilter, because we have too much of one and not enough of the other. I mean, I think there's definitely a balance that needs to be met of both, you know, male and female energy, if I'm not getting too new agey on anybody. We've never set out to destroy anyone's faith, certainly, and I certainly see the need that people have to have a faith. And I would hope that you know, this could be embraced. I don't know, you know, I can't predict the future, but certainly for myself, I know that it has changed my belief, but I think in a better way for the positive. Bruce?
And you, Bruce?
Well, I think Renee's right. I mean, I think I said earlier that we've been very careful not to proclaim from the rooftops that we have this is the body of Mary Magdalene, or this is the tomb of Jesus. I think because it's more serious than that. It's more serious than all the cheap shots that, you know, people have taken in the past. And there have been an awful lot of cheap shots. And, of course, the Vatican, their standard line is a kind of rolling of the eyeballs and a yawn, which is, where's the tomb of Jesus today? You know, Kansas City or Calcutta, because it seems to pop up on a regular basis that people are doing these amazing finds. And we thought, what we found is more serious to us, and we believe to everyone else. And that, I think if we can just start to widen the debate, and I think people will start to coalesce around the material and the debate. What do I think will happen down the line? I think within a decade or less, you'll, just like the reversal of Mary Magdalene being a prostitute, where the Vatican in, I think it was 1969, had to admit there was absolutely no evidence for her to have been a prostitute for all those centuries. I think you will hear, you know, Benedict or his, with clenched teeth, or his successor, saying, well, you know, I think they probably were married, and based, you know, they'll just do the presidential thing, which is based on the information at the time, that's what you thought, and now it's different. But I think the impact on that, on women priests, on marriages, on everything the church has victimized for so long, from mentally handicapped people to left-handed people to gay people, you know, I think there will be a new dawn. And time and time again, this idea of apocalypse has come back to us. We talk a bit about it on our website. It's apparently, and stand to be corrected, but the apocalypse, one of the interpretations from the original Greek, means literally revelation. And, yeah, of course, people are talking about, you know, earthquakes and disasters. It could be as simple as just a rebirth of Christianity, where we it's inclusive and not exclusive, that we finally embrace women wholly and other communities. And it's not about how different we are. It's about how similar we are. You know, and would that be a sea change? Would that be phenomenal? Would that be a tsunami of faith that this civilization? Absolutely. It may even pull us back from the brink, from, you know, kind of, you know, disaster, which is essentially all religious-based. Are we thinking about that when we're pulling out stuff from the ground? No, we're just little people doing, you know, what we can do. I think this may really become, this Priory described it as a roller coaster, as a snowball. Mm. They said, you know, at the moment, yeah, we're kind of trolling it, but maybe it's going to get bigger than you can handle. And honestly, for me and, you know, my eventual kids and grandkids and whatever, I think it would be great. You know, because all I've ever wanted to do from day one through to now, day whatever it is, X thousand, was get to the truth. Selfishly.
Exactly.
So I'm not doing it. I never did this to really just do a film. I want to know, what's the truth? Because how are we ever going to know really about the origins of our civilization? How are we ever going to know where we came from or where we're going unless we actually tell the truth?
Well, I'm on your page, and as soon as you find the truth, I expect a phone call because I want to know the truth that you're saying tonight. We have a caller real quickly. Hopefully we can get him on because I would like to take a couple of real quick last comments from you. Kevin from Tampa is on line 3. Kevin, do you have a question for our guest, please?
Yes, I do have a question. I wanted to know, what was the greatest obstacle you guys faced while filming Bloodline?
That's easy, money. You know, it's really funny. You know, when we started out this project, we did have a company that was funding us, and shortly after we got rolling and actually got into production, unfortunately they began to fail us, and we had to terminate with them, and then we had to strike out on our own and raise every penny of it ourselves. And we were just talking with someone over the weekend about that and how, in a way, it seemed like it was really supposed to be that way, and sort of like as Bruce was speaking about earlier, how the Priory would give us information that we could work out on our own, but they'd never just answer a question directly or just say, oh, hey, Bruce and Renee, go look over here. It was never anything like that. It was always a puzzle of some kind, something that had to be worked out. And I feel that sort of that's the way it had to be all the way down the line. We had to work for it, and I think that's the only way we were going to get it, but that was a huge obstacle.
But every time we ran out of money, and we were literally, you know, beyond broke, we'd spend all our money, our savings, our credit cards, and we had nothing. A phone call would come in within 48 hours, and someone would say, here's 2,000, you know, 20,000, and then in one case, someone came in with a few hundred thousand, and you've got to understand, I'm coming from someone who doesn't have a religion or a faith, so I wasn't thanking Jesus or anyone. If I was thanking anyone, it was the universe. And, you know, for someone who always thought that was claptrap, I'd hear people going, I asked the universe, and I got a check for $10,000, and I went, yeah, right, you know. It actually happened. You know, we would just sit here looking at each other, not knowing what to do, and we would get a phone call who said, I'm not quite sure why I'm doing this, but I read about you, I heard about you, and I want to help you. What can I do? And he said, give us $10,000. And I went, okay.
And Kevin, there were literally times when Bruce would be on a plane headed for Europe, and we didn't have a way for him to, we didn't have a hotel room for him to stay in, a rental car, or anything once he landed in Europe. And I was literally raising money while he was flying transatlantically. It was hilarious. But somehow it always came through. It was just amazing.
Well, I'll tell you, this is just an amazing movie. For those of you that have been listening to us, the movie will be released on May 9th, Bloodline, directed by Bruce Burgess and produced by Renee Barnett. Thank you so much. Tomorrow night, just for just so you know, and then we'll get real back to you real quickly, I will be interviewing our guest, Phil Donahue, and he will be introducing his new documentary, Body of War. Wednesday night, Professor Lauren Murray, world-renowned expert on depleted uranium, with our host David Swanson on Wednesday nights. And as we're wrapping this up, Renee, first of all, and Bruce, I want to thank you so much. This is just a fantastic documentary. I can't tell you how enthralled I was by it. I urge everyone to go out and see it. What real in like one sentence each, what do you want them to know about this film?
Well, what I'd really like to, for them to know right now, Basma, if I can get in a shameless plug, is for everyone to go to the website, www.bloodlinethemovie.com, and there's lots of information, lots of news, photographs, tons of clips that you won't even see in the film. We had so much material that we wanted to share with everyone. Our real challenge was what to leave out of the film. So there's lots of information there for people with we'd love for people to visit us there.
Well, thank you very much. And you, Bruce?
I'd like to appeal to the people like me, which is really why I did the film, you know, who are looking for, looking for the truth, to, you know, go to the website and look at the film, because I think the subject's really important, you know, for us all. I hope that people listening, from people who've seen the film, will find it as entertaining as they will kind of, informing and educational. It was a hell of a journey and a hell of a ride. I'm not sure it was fun to do, but it was a hell of a challenge, and I think that comes across in the film.
Well, I want to thank you both. Again, that's Bloodline. Thank you very much for being with us. It was an honor. I'll be rooting for you, and thank you all very much. It's been a wonderful evening. Go to the website, great movie, great site, great everything. Good night, Bruce. Good night, Renee. Thank you very much. Two thumbs up from Basma on this one.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the sea wall, by the relief of the fast, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land my land, from California to the New York Island, the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters, yeah.
Hi, I'm Sylvie Avery. Join Mick and I on the Spirits Work Show for the most unique and fascinating hour of communication with the spirit world you're ever likely to hear. Every Monday at 7 p.m. PST and Thursday at 1 p.m. PST. Visit our website at www.spirit-teaching.com to find out more about us. Buy our books online from our site. See our ever-growing list of audio CDs on subjects from this show. Have an Akashic reading from your book of life. Uncover truth and knowledge to empower you through your life. Direct from the spirit world, spirit guide Gregory Hay.